always in and out of trouble, but mostly always in. Using daddy's necktie for the tail of your kite. Using mommy's lipstick for the letters you write. So the clock says 7:30, it's really after 10. Looks like Lulu's been repairing it again.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined in the studio by an author, editor, and comics hunter. His forays into the archives of artists and collectors have resulted in such books as Oregon Trail, The Road to Destiny, To Laugh That We May Not Weep, The Carter Family, Don't Forget This Song, and Little Lulu, Working Girl. Frank Young, great to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Frank, congratulations on the big rollout of the Little Lulu collection. This is from Drawn and Quarterly. The first volume is called Little Lulu, Working Girl. This is sounds like this is years in the works.
It's been a project I've wanted to get done for at least a decade, and I tried it with three different publishers. But the problem was none of them could find out who owned the rights to the Little Lulu character. Since Dell Books went out of business in the 70s, the character has just bounced around from one corporation to the other. And Dark Horse Comics here in Portland had a five-year license on the character. And by the time they had finished, it had switched hands and nobody could find it out. But Tom Devlin in Canada scouted around and found out that NBC Universal owned the character. And furthermore, they were very happy to have someone take a stagnant property and make something happen with it. So they've been very hands-off with these books. I think they're just pleasantly delighted that this thing they acquired in a big batch of things is worth something to somebody.
And shout out to Tom Devlin. This is your collaborator on this project.
Yes, he contacted me a couple of years ago and said, Frank, let's do this, because he and I had been discussing doing a big project on the creator of these comics, John Stanley, for quite a while. He had read and enjoyed a blog that I've kept for over 10 years called Stanley Stories, which I used as sort of a public showcase for the research I was doing into the career of John Stanley. I got interested in his work in the 1980s and realized that there was a lot more to what he had done than Little Lulu. And because he never signed a story until 1964, I took stories that I knew were by him and sort of used them as a yardstick to ferret out other things.
Well, I want to get familiar with John Stanley in just a moment, but first, I want to start at the very beginning because, not everybody knows about Little Lulu, and I was a grade schooler at the tail end of the Dell Comics era that you were talking about, and Little Lulu was still going strong at the time, but yeah, let's start at the beginning. A very talented cartoonist back in the 1920s by the name of Marjorie Henderson Buell. She'd been writing and drawing comics for various magazines. And then around 1934, 1935, the Saturday Evening Post came calling and they asked her to create a new single panel comic, and it was going to replace Carl Anderson's Henry. And Marge, as everybody called her, she said that, okay, a girl character could get away with more hijinks than a boy character could.
And that was a novel choice. And the Little Lulu of her panel cartoons will be a shock to anyone that knows the comic book stories.
She was a real imp.
Yeah, she. Some of the things that she did would have people calling protective services these days. She would set fire to curtains, do questionable things to house pets, maim plants, and always with a complete deadpan. There's almost a Charles Adams vibe to some of the gag cartoons, but they were extraordinarily popular, and the character was very successfully marketed. And in 1944, Western Publications, which was a comics packaging company that created comics titles which Dell Comics bought from them and published, acquired the rights to the character, and they assigned the creation of a comic book version to a young writer and cartoonist named John Stanley, who was about a year, year and a half into his comic book career. And he had started out writing stories for animated cartoon characters like Tom and Jerry and Woody Woodpecker. And these artists and writers were given complete freedom. He pretty much reinvented the characters. The versions in the comic books looked like the versions in the movie theaters, but they did not act like the characters.
And also John Stanley, and we'll get more into him, but he also fleshed out some of Little Lulu's companions, and famously Tubby, who was sort of her foil, but also Annie and Alvin.
Yeah, he created those latter two characters because he realized he understood that the Lulu as she existed in the Marge panels, there was really no way to sustain storylines around her. You know, she could burn down the hospital, deforest an area or whatever, but it would just be pages and pages of her getting in and out of mischief. So he gave her a character and realized that she needed foils. And so the character who was called Joe in the panels was renamed Tubby. And then she created the character Alvin as a real antagonist, a younger child who's just pretty much, you know, a little anarchist, especially in the earlier stories, a character that is wilder than she could ever be.
And then Lulu and Annie would team up when the boys would do something obnoxious, and they would find some way of getting some very clever revenge on them.
These stories. There's a big thread in Stanley's Little Lulu of stories that can really be seen as feminist. He was very pro children. There's a sense in his stories that he understands how little rights children have and how much they struggle to have a place in the world. But he also understood the battle of the sexes and was able to play out adult tensions between the genders by using children. And he did this brilliantly in a number of stories.
Right. I think, a lot of critics like to call Lulu a tomboy. And, I'm not really sure that readers see her that way, that reductively. She's not rough and tumble. She's got, these sort of ring curls, mm-hmm. and she wears dresses. But she's not a little princess either. She's just a high-spirited, curious kid with a lot of clever ideas and a bit of mischief up her sleeve.
Yes, and as the series goes on, Lulu becomes more and more this voice of reason in her universe. She becomes the smartest kid in the room, and she feels that there's things she has to stand up for, like when her rights are violated or she sees someone else getting picked on. And she's not a goody two-shoes or a know-it-all, but she just has this wonderful confidence.
Oh yeah, she's very, very headstrong with her parents sometimes when, and kind of like in some of the best comics and animation, the parents are doing dumb things and she's reacting to those with her own mind.
Yes. And, that's another wonderful thing about these stories is the interplay between adults and children. And Stanley points out, without ever overdoing it, how foolish the behavior of adults can be. And it's an interesting contrast between the very pragmatic, matter-of-fact, get-the-job-done attitude of Lulu and the sometimes lovably inept actions of her parents.
Well, yeah, you can see reverberations down the line even today. Yvette Kaplan, the animation director for Beavis and Butthead, and South Park, the guys behind South Park, you know, they have the same sort of thing with these idiot adults and these kids who are just sort of doing their own thing in the absence of authority, of authority figures that make any sense. And, you know, this is, I want to mention that this is back in the 40s, that yes, there was the height of the Little Lulu craze. This was also a time when the silver screen was full of headstrong women like Rosalind Russell, Barbara Stanwyck, Dorothy Dandridge, Claudette Colbert, Lauren Bacall.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's no surprise that there was a concurrent Little Lulu animated series, which we heard a bit of the theme song from at the beginning of the show. At the same time that Stanley was developing the comic book version, a New York-based studio called Famous Studios did a series of 26 Little Lulu animated shorts. And it's fascinating to see these two very different versions of the same character happening at the same time. And of course, that's something that just would not happen today due to corporations being so teeth-grindingly difficult about what you can and can't do with their characters.
There was a lot of crossover back in the 40s, 50s with animators and comics artists. Really classic comics artists like Hank Ketcham, who did Dennis the Menace, and Pogo's Walt Kelly. They started out at Disney. They were very much into dynamic poses and things like that. And you see that also with some of the Little Lulu comics, that they've got this incredible, you know, dynamic, propulsive kind of feel to them.
Yeah, and I think that came from John Stanley. And you mentioned Walt Kelly, who was a co-worker at Western Publications with John Stanley. They were good friends. And Walt Kelly often mentions John Stanley's name in comic book stories. He has in an early Pogo story, there's a wanted poster with, I think it's Pretty Boy John Stanley. And occasionally in the Pogo newspaper strip, the little skiff that the characters cruise about on in the swamp will have John Stanley on the side.
Wow. And we want to mention that John Stanley had a few favorite artists that collaborated with him. He did a lot of the writing. Irving Tripp was one of his favorite artists.
He was another staff artist at Western. John Stanley wrote and drew the entirety of the first three Little Lulu comics, which are, which we have in toto in the first volume. It was really important to Tom and I that these three comics be reprinted correctly, because in the past versions of these reprints, all the stories before 1949 or so are from traced versions, because there were no photostats.
So somebody traced them. They weren't the original handwork of the artist, handiwork of the artists.
They were a publisher in the 80s did a big deluxe hardcover set of Little Lulu, and he discovered that there were no photostats before a certain time. So he had amateur artists lightbox the stories. Ugh. And it's kind of like a colorized film. It's like you're getting the essence of it, but it's just not right. And unfortunately, when Dark Horse did their book series, they just scanned the hardcover books. And so you had these trace stories appearing again.
So you did your Bloodhound work to find these originals wherever you could. You have a lot of connections in the collector world.
I do, but I actually owned all but two of the comics that were used for this first volume.
Wow.
So, there's a lot of my scanning in these books. Many hours spent sitting there patiently waiting for the scanner to go from point A to point B. And then, the folks at Drawn and Quarterly do a really nice job of taking out the kind of yellowish brown tone of the aged newsprint and doing what they can to correct the worst of the printing blunders. But we really wanted to publish these stories as they looked when they were new.
Right. And right, with the off-register colors and everything, yes.
And, of course, there have been some people that have complained about that, but I find a real warmth and charm to that. It's like a record with a little bit of crackle on it, where you still enjoy it thoroughly, and there's something about those little artifacts that is pleasing. It's, you know,
20th century analog technology.
Yes, applied to digital, you know, the digital world of the 21st century.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Frank Young. He's the co-editor, along with Tom Devlin, of the new Little Lulu collection from Drawn and Quarterly. And Frank, you were mentioning that John Stanley was a really prolific writer, most notably of the Little Lulu stories, but also just a huge range of classic comics.
Yeah, he was kind of the golden boy of Oscar Lebec, who was the editor at Western Publications. And Stanley wrote stories for, as I said before, Tom and Jerry, Woody Woodpecker, Andy Panda, even a cringe-inducing African-American character called Little 8-Ball. And then later he did a wonderful comic book series based on the radio and movie series Henry Aldrich, which gave him a chance to write about teenagers. And he even undertook an attempt to adapt George Harriman's Crazy Cat into comic book form, which isn't always successful.
I can't imagine it would be.
But I've got to give him credit for trying, and the stories do have their moments.
Okay.
And later on, he worked with Lulu until the end of the 50s, and he was pretty burned out on the series. He had written over 8,000 pages of stories.
8,000 pages.
And of those, he had illustrated about 700 of them. And I think he had mined all the variations on themes that he could possibly come up with. That was 14 years of constant work. And they moved him over to a comic book version of Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy, which was just kind of a sideways move. And he got a little wilder in those.
Yeah, it was. He worked on the Nancy and Sluggo comic books. The original Nancy comic strip was, of course, created by Ernie Bushmiller. And there's a great quote by the cartoonist Wally Wood. He once remarked that it's harder not to read Nancy than to read it. And, you know, I actually might say the same thing of Little Lulu. There's a simplicity to the art and the dialogue that can keep the reader turning the pages. And I might get in trouble with Nancy fans for this. I had Bill Griffith on the show. He's working on an autobiography of Ernie Bushmiller.
Oh, yes.
Little Lulu seems a lot more character-driven than Nancy. Nancy seems more gag-driven. The simplicity of Lulu's world is a bit deceptive. There's a lot of really authentic childhood drama playing out under the surface.
Oh, yes. That is the reason why we're looking at these stories, which were created with no thought that anyone would be thinking about them even a year later, 2 years later. They were printed on cheap comic books that were just disposable, ephemeral reading matter. And John Stanley himself later practically bragged to someone who had written him a letter that he'd never saved any of his comics. He claimed it was just a job to him, but he is a writer, I believe, on the level of a Joseph Heller or a Philip Roth in terms of his wit, his cynicism, his understanding of narrative stakes and of the rise and fall of status. And he was a great wordsmith. Part of the joy of these comics is how well they're written.
I do want to mention how far the reach of Little Lulu goes. Back in 1994, a group of women cartoonists got together and created a nonprofit organization called Friends of Lulu. There were some really, really heavy hitters in the comics world. Trina Robbins, Lee Mars, Heidi McDonald, and Annina Bennett. And Annina is a frequent guest, friend of the show. She's a fabulous comics writer. And she was hoping to join us in the studio this morning, but is out in Baltimore, a very, very busy, talented person. One more fan of Lulu, though, is, and this is amazing, none other than Booker Prize-winning poet, novelist, and sage, Margaret Atwood. And Margaret Atwood writes the introduction to this first volume that you've published of the Little Lulu strips.
Yes, and I have to say, it's staggering to consider that my writing is under the same covers as Margaret Atwood. I have a long afterword in the back of the book, but she was apparently a childhood fan, and she wrote her introduction is wonderful. I want to read just a little bit of it. I'm quoting from there. "I haven't yet cited Little Lulu, but I will do so now. What were the life lessons taught to me by this diminutive but curly-headed prankster? 1, it's okay to have curls. 2, it's okay to be short. 3, it's okay to be female. 4, storytelling is a skill, and putting beebleberries, witches, or witch substitutes and suspense into the mixture definitely leavens the lump. 5, if you hide in the bushes and eavesdrop, you can learn some very useful things. Just don't sneeze."
Wow, that's amazing. Once again, we're talking about John Stanley, the artist who took over from Marge, who was the creator who did the Little Lulu single panels in the Saturday Evening Post. So John Stanley takes over, and John Stanley then creates some other really interesting projects on his own. Melvin Monster, 13 going on 18.
Yes, he in the early 60s, he decided he wanted to get back to being a cartoonist, because his value as a writer, Western publications had cartoonists by the score, but they had only a few really talented writers, so he had to step down from being an artist. And I think he just wanted to get back to the drawing board, and he worked at home and produced these two comics. And 13 Going on 18 is a masterful, very melancholy look at adolescence.
Yeah, it's more anarchic. Well, the early Archie comics were very anarchic and sort of toned themselves down after a while. But 13 Going on 18 had that same sort of frazzled energy.
Yeah, you feel the raw nerves rubbing against each other, and it really captures this sense of hormonal frustration.
Yeah, the bad decisions of adolescence.
Yes, and it sort of predates the comedy of something like The Office or Curb Your Enthusiasm. Stanley thrived on this idea. You have a character make a bad decision, commit to it with passion, and push it forward as you sit there reading and thinking, oh, please don't go there, while you're fixated to the page.
So you have been responsible or collaborated on so many projects of bringing these sidelined comics out of the shadows and into the light of day. And there's one passion project, and I've got this in my hands too, and I don't want to pass this one up. This is a personal project that you've done, and it's Cecil Jensen's Elmo. This is another newspaper strip from back in the mid-century, back in the 40s.
Yeah, it started in late 1946.
The Elmo is like nothing else. You open this book, and as soon as you think it's going in one direction, it takes a wild left turn. It's like Little Abner meets Terry and the Pirates meets Being John Malkovich.
With a little touch of Nathaniel West in the mix. Jensen was an editorial cartoonist who started out in the mid-1920s and had tried a couple of newspaper strips that didn't work out, but he apparently had a bee in his bonnet to do something different, and he dropped this strip into the world. It's a hair-raising comic strip. I mean, it has moments in it. There are things where you'll read it, and then 3 hours later, you'll get the joke, you know, which means you're standing in the checkout line at the store, and you just go, wah-ha-ha-ha, and then like, I can't really explain why I'm laughing, but I am. But it's a strip that I have loved since I chanced upon it in high school. And while I was undergoing cancer treatment over the last few years, this was my occupational therapy. I decided I was going to restore this comic strip. And I just worked on it every day and kind of developed a system that I finally got good results from terrible sources. I mean, I could do an entire show on the criminal sins of newspaper printing in post-war America. But I'm very happy with the way the book turned out. And I'm also happy that people really seem to get this strip now. When it came out, I saw this cycle in my research of papers picked it up, and one paper dropped it about 7 or 8 weeks into it. It was a hot potato. There were certain moments where you could just see some editor, you know, going, oh.
It's so deceptive looking. It's got these beautiful rich blacks and these beautifully rendered characters and situations.
Yeah, it's visually very conservative. I mean, you look at it and it's just people standing around talking, but when you read the dialogue, it still has the power to...
It's just surreal.
And surreal and jolting. And often very, very funny in a way that defies what you normally think of humor is. And I'm glad to have brought this back into the world. And the other day I got an email from Cecil Jensen's granddaughter.
Oh, wow.
And she just wanted to say how happy her family was that I've taken on the cause of their grandfather. And I'm going to be doing a second volume.
Yeah, because Elmo eventually morphed into another strip entirely, one with very little resemblance to its earlier anarchic self.
Yeah, it became a quietly surreal kid strip called Little Debbie that has nothing to do with the snack cake brand. And apparently, he'd introduced this character, and the readership cottoned to her in a way they didn't to Elmo. So the syndicate said, let's get this Elmo guy out of here.
Well, there's Elmo, and the main book that we've been talking about today is Little Lulu, Working Girl. The co-editor, along with Tom Devlin, is Frank Young. Frank, it's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. I hope I've been reasonably articulate.
Well, absolutely. How can listeners find out more about Little Lulu and about your other projects?
Elmo is available on Amazon.com and will soon be available from Bud Plant Art Books. Little Lulu you can find out by visiting Drawn and Quarterly's website or looking on Amazon or other online retailers.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. Many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.